My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Dave for picking me up at the airport. Lately, I've been getting a bad run. They've been sending crippled girls to pick me up. And I got to carry my own bags. I got this big...
Here they all are, Dave.
Whenever you need a dirty job done, you look for an old defensive lineman. And they've been hitting the helmet a lot. They just... We had a good time. We talked a little sports, had a little fun, and he really was a good host, and I appreciate it. I want to thank my friend Bill Kay, who gave me a little tour of the Ohio State campus today. Showed me a number of doors that were locked to interesting places. Took me to see the Santa Maria, where they wouldn't let us on. There were some Navy, three or four Navy guys, young guys working on it, and I told them I'd been in the old Navy, and they didn't care, and I... I got a good chance to see a lot of streets and to miss a couple buses very closely at intersections. No, we had a good time. Enjoyed it. Each of the speakers has said this, but this is really correct, I think. I've really enjoyed this weekend. I'm going to enjoy tomorrow morning. I've enjoyed the speakers. I've enjoyed the fellowship. I've enjoyed the people. Last night, Jack, my old friend Jack from Pittsburgh, opening up, and I'm not sure what he was talking about, but it was good. Did you ever get sober, Jack? Yes, you did. And then after him, we had this slick from Las Vegas who just hip and slick and cool and made you envy him. And if I didn't know what was going on inside of his head, I'd really think he was a good guy. But they both gave grade A talks. That's the name of this game. And this morning we had a little workshop, and I enjoyed listening to Tom give a fine talk on the home group and the reasons why we do the things we do. And tomorrow morning, Tom will speak again. I did something for Tom today that he probably doesn't recognize. I want to tell you, Tom, I'm going to call it to your attention. We had an hour and 15 minutes to share. I sat down in 29 minutes and gave him 45. That is your birthday present forever. But I am glad to be here, and I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober. I first came to Columbus, I guess, in the early 1970s, and I've been here several times. I always enjoyed it. I like the Midwest. I'm from the Midwest. And there's one more thing I must say. I wish I wouldn't have to say this, but two things. All weekend long, I've been wondering, where is the flag for the year 2000? There's 95, 96, 97, 98, 99... All right, that takes care of that. And the other thing, I don't know what's coming over AA, but nearly all the new people in their first 2 weeks of sobriety look healthier than I did. There's something wrong with that concept. Although I'm sure it wasn't like it was in Montana a few years ago. I was up in Montana, and they're giving a signed big book to the newest person sober, and they gave it at the Saturday night meeting, and the girl had 2 hours sober, and she had been there in the afternoon, and she confided chuckling to one of her friends, I went out and had a drink with dinner because I wanted to get the book. It sounds funny, but I don't think she's got much of a future in AA. I was listening to the stories that people told, Bob and Jack and how we all come here, and we wonder what we all, I know new people are here wondering what you have in common with all these people. And you look around. I came to AA and I never really could figure out what they say. We're all together, but we're not all together at all. We look different, act different, sound different, have different backgrounds, have different drinking experiences, entirely different. And it just makes you kind of feel, I don't think I'm going to fit in here. And it's there's a thing in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous book, that talks about that. And I'd read it maybe 15 times I heard it read, before I realized that they were talking about people like me, and I suppose like you. Now, you may wonder what we all have in common, but if you are, I'll tell you how you can, one way you can tell. If you are like us, you will somewhere along the line have voluntarily or involuntarily accepted the concept that you are going to someday control and enjoy your drinking. And it says that's the great obsession of all of us, that we are going to do that. And we says many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. That doesn't sound like very much, but that's one thing we all have in common. We all thought, maybe I can find a way to do it. Maybe I can find a way to drink. It doesn't mean, we don't count alcoholism so much by if you've been in jail 100 times or 10 nut houses or all these things. These are all nice podium flash. But what it is when you get the position where you keep drinking when you shouldn't drink, and you know you shouldn't drink. In the first page or two of chapter 3 in our book, if you read that and think about it, you may find yourself more than any place else in the book. The rest of the book's full of a lot of good information, but that seems to be always been designed. It talks about people like us. It says we have to concede to our innermost selves that we are truly alcoholic. I never could do that. I always felt my case was different. I never could feel I was really an alcoholic. And it said we keep working on it. We have occasional brief recoveries followed always by still worse relapse. And we all know that feeling. Just think you got it together. I've got a way to do this, and all of a sudden it blows up on you. Then you keep drinking till you, I love this choice of words, it's so tasty. You get to a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I used to think, that's how drunk you get. Boy, you get pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. But that is now you get when you're drunk. That's how you get when you're sober after you've been drunk. Then comes pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and they want reasons for your actions, and you haven't got them. And it's just a terrible guilt and loss. But the great thing, of course, about people like us, the thing that kills us but saves us also, is that Mother Nature always puts a scab on everything, and pretty soon it doesn't seem so bad, and pretty soon I'll try it again. And so we, people like me, have a great deal of difficulty here. I'm in a slightly different position, I'm sure, than most of you. And then the nature of my work today, which is kind of, I've been doing it for a few years, was kind of unusual. When I go to work in the morning, I get out of my car, I step over the bodies of men and women dying from alcoholism to get to my office. And when I get done at night, I step over the bodies of men and women dying from alcoholism and drug addiction to get to my car and go home. You'd think this would really be terrible, but nothing is really terrible after you're used to it. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. I'm used to it. I know these people well. And when I first went there to do that job, I used to think, I can help these people. I can make a difference in their lives. And I used to spend a lot of time talking to them. And I had very little luck. Very little luck. And I used to be very discouraged. I had to stop and think, if Alcoholics Anonymous could be transmitted by good wishes by the sender, there'd be a lot of more people sober. If that were true, I would not have slipped year after 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 year. The worst years of my life came after good people tried to tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous, took me to meetings, showed me all about it, told me it would change my life. And I look back and think, why in the world would I not accept it? Because I am not a masochist. I don't like pain. There are people who are into pain and sometimes get their jollies out of it. But I don't. I like comfort and ease and hedonism. And why would I be like that? And that baffled me for a long time. And the last day I drank, a long time ago, I knew I wasn't an alcoholic and bet my life on it. You know, I came here, I think, talked about that same thing many, many years ago. And when I was a young man and the juices were vital, now it's a little bit longer. I'm getting a little older and a little longer in the tooth, as they say. And I'm 73, and I look back and think, God, look at that. I can't imagine why that was that way. But there are some pleasures of being 73. There are some drawbacks of being 73. When I turned 70, they started giving me iron tablets for my blood. And I guess that's supposed to help you. I don't know. But a few months ago, I was reading too many ads. That's the downside of being 73. I tried a Viagra. And I did not know that if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now, every 4 hours, I face north. At least it isn't as bad as one old guy in our group who always says, I take an eighth of a Viagra every morning. I said, why do you do that, Jim? Just so I won't pee on my shoes. At the age of 73 now, coming up to 74 in a month or two, I look back and look at myself standing on that street corner at 31, and I was an old man. I was older than I am now by far. I was an old sick man. I was standing there because two big guys had just thrown me out of a Skid Row mission and said, stay out of here, you troublemaking bum. And I tried to explain to them, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running at Very Week and Life and Time and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside of that mission on a cold autumn morning, and a slight rain falling, and I was sick and desperate. I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now, and I'm sure some of you have had it. It's the feeling when you might push it so far that you get to a point where there's no friendly direction. There's no place to go back to. There's no place. If you take that direction long enough, someone's going to be glad to see you. It's just all negative. And I had a... I felt... this. I remember thinking, this must be a dream. I'm going to wake up any minute and my wife's going to be saying, Clancy, get up and go to the work. You know, you kicked off all your covers. But it wasn't a dream. And I stood there, I was just baffled. How could I be in this situation? In a city where I don't know anybody, where things are... my life is over. I'm an old man, sick and desperate. If some old guy had come up to me that morning on the street and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost your career. You've lost your home, lost two homes. Lost all your clothing, left them in Phoenix, where you lost the car that you're trying to drive across the country before they put you in jail and the guy kicked your front teeth out. I know that happened because my lips were bleeding and my teeth were gone. He said, now you've been going to AA off and on almost 10 years now around the country, various places, and you sit in these meetings and think how dumb these people are and how they don't really understand your sensitivities and your intelligence. He said, you're dying. Why don't you go back, if you'd have said, why don't you go back to AA one more morning and just admit you're an alcoholic and do something about it before you die? And if a guy had said that to me, I'd have to say, pal, you just don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were an alcoholic. My life would be so much simpler if I could be one of those people who just stopped drinking and go to AA and feel better. But I'm not an alcoholic. And if he had said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic, I wouldn't have been able to do that. I wouldn't have had the objectivity to stand back and delineate the differences. So I probably would have done what frightened people like me do when they get cornered. And that is you take refuge behind bluster. And you say things like, get out of my face! Screw off, you! I don't know the right answer. I know the answer now. I've known it for a long time. I don't know. It's very easy. I know something the new people here probably don't know. I know the answer. It's very simple, because in those years I was in and out of AA in different cities, different states, I didn't learn much about staying sober, but I learned what an alcoholic was. And I'm not really an alcoholic. So that begs the question, what's an alcoholic? Well, I'll tell you this. If you're new tonight, or kind of new, I'll tell you this. If there's a speaker meeting in your community, and you go to it every once a week for the next year, you will hear 52 versions of this talk. You'll hear people saying this. Yes, I used to drink and my life was terrible. I came to AA and found this program, and now I'm feeling better. There's a lot of filigrees and differences and different aspects, but that's what always is the story of Alcoholics Anonymous speakers. And that's what I could not accept, because of something entirely different in my life. I could talk drinking stories. I've been in jail a lot. I'm no big felon, but I have a terrible failing. When I get to a certain amount of drinking, it is necessary for me to counsel police officers and point out errors they may be making. And on several occasions, I've stepped in to stop unjust arrests and gone instead. But I get in jail a lot overnight. I'm no big convict like Tom. I'm just a misunderstood type of guy. And I've been in hospitals, in veterans hospitals, in state hospitals, all sorts of places. And I could always go to AA and talk about drinking with anybody. But I could talk about coming to AA, I've been to AA and have good sponsors. But the one difference that I could never overcome, I look back now, it's kind of funny. One of the things I always used to think about in those days, I may have a lot of problems, but I've never sold out my integrity. By God, I'm not a sellout. And after I was sober a while and looked back, that's all I ever did was sell out. I sold out my integrity to hold a job, to hold a girl, to get out of a jam, to do this and that. Always selling out. But by now, it was kind of funny. The only tattered shred of integrity I had left was the integrity, but I'm not really an alcoholic. And I bet my life on it. For one simple reason. Unlike alcoholics, is when I get sober and find the program, that's when my life gets painful. And the longer I stay sober, the worse it gets. And I can stay sober sometimes for a while and feel pretty good, but I'll tell you what happens to me. After I'm sober a little while, somebody sneaks into my bedroom in the middle of the night and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning when I get up, they start, and I start getting restless and a little irritable with all this crap. And I don't really enjoy this concept of being treated like a child, and on and on. When you're young, you can, get no trouble drinking. You go on the wagon, and it's great. You go on the wagon. Okay, I've had some trouble drinking. I'm going on the wagon. And you go for a few days till you get a little nervous and edgy. Well, see, I can do it. But as you get older, something bad happens. You find yourself having to make promises to people when you get sober, to your wife, to your children, to your employer, to a probation officer, to a judge, to somebody. And then now you stop drinking, and it's okay, but pretty soon the heat's out again. And now you can't drink, which adds to your anger and rage and frustration. And a long time ago, I heard a guy in an inventory that he was taking me mention something that I almost fell out of the seat, because that's something I had done. I must have done it 30 times and never once knew what I've done. And it's a pattern in my life, and it seems to be a pattern in some people's lives. When I get in a real pressure and I can't drink, I somehow, without even being aware of it, I set up a beef with the person that I promised, my wife or someone else. Okay, you're going to be like that? I'm trying to do the best I can for you. You treat me like a piece of crap. Why should I even stop drinking for you? To hell with you. And never even know that coming out of my own mind. But I wish I were an alcoholic. I do. I wish that of what I am, some kind of a person with funny emotions. Just a person with funny emotions. All my life, it seems to me that I've had strange emotions, intermittent feelings of being terribly inadequate and not fitting in and not being part of things. And people don't seem to, there seems to be something missing in me, and I don't know what it is, but when people get close, it's almost as though they can see it's missing and they don't like me anymore, but they won't tell me what I should be doing to change it. I can't sustain one-to-one relationships with people, men or women, very long. It wasn't until I was sober some time that I discovered why that was. And you may identify with this if you're kind of new, but I did this a lot of years and never knew it. When you don't have much self-approval or self-worth, you have to get your approval from outside of you. So, I need someone who's going to continually reinforce my self-approval. So if we're going to have a one-to-one relationship or even fall in love, all you have to do is treat me special every day of my life. I don't realize I'm doing it, but I can look back and see it. If you treat me special, I feel average. If you treat me average, I feel rejected. And I'll tell you something, no one's going to treat you special every day, always, because that's just not the way lives work. After a while, it's a mark of acceptance that they treat you just ordinary. But to me, that meant they didn't like me anymore, and I was gone. And I can't sustain anything. And this has bothered me. When I was working in advertising and making some money, I spent a lot of money and a lot of time in psychoanalysis to get to the bottom of these emotions. I don't like these emotions. I want to find out why I've got them. And I found out that I had been, well, for example, I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church up in Wisconsin. You know, that's the team that comes down here and beats you all the time. That's not true. You beat Wisconsin all the time. We remember every victory. Anyway, but I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, a very strict church. I didn't know it was a strict church. That's just over in Norwegian Lutheran. And they have very, you know, kind of strict rules. You don't break commandments. And one of the things they say about it seems kind of odd, but even people who are married for 30 years would never make love standing up, just in the fear that some passerby might think they were dancing. You know, it's a strict church. And I liked it. I had one little problem. I seemed to need more fun than most Lutherans. So I got in trouble early on, and by the time I was 14, I was damned. But it wasn't the church's fault. And in psychoanalysis later, I discovered that the Norwegian Lutheran Church had psychologically repressed me and left deep psychic scars. How would you like to find that out about your church? If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. Hire a couple of codependents and sit around and be pissed off every week. I discovered that I'd been hurt by the depression. Didn't even know there'd been a depression. But when I found out, I could see how I'd been hurt. I'd been deprived. I'd been hurt by the war because I ran away to sea when I was 15 years old. And I was out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean before my mother didn't know I was up in Duluth or Superior visiting my aunt. And I always thought that was one of the great memories of my life, but I discovered now that it has left deep psychic scars. I discovered a lot of things. I used to come out of there almost with tears of self-pity rolling down my cheeks and just think, I've been just screwed my whole life. It's just, no wonder I feel bad. And it helped me a lot, except for about a year later, I suddenly realized that I felt so good that I knew these things, but it suddenly struck me, I still had all the feelings. I just knew why I had them. Didn't help. The only possible use for that information might be late at night in a bar somewhere, some big moose. And say, you talk a lot. What the hell's wrong with you? And you can tell them. Well, I was repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I did a lot of things. I read books, and some I understood and some I didn't. But of all the things that ever helped me is when I was that boy, restless and irritable and discontent, but full of zip when I was 15 and hitchhiked to San Francisco. My mother was going to Spirit. I lied my age and got some merchant marine papers, and crying for merchant seamen early in the war. And I was on a ship going out to the Pacific, and I was 15, and everybody kind of treated me like I was a goof, and I was a goof. This tall with face full of pimples and just dumb. And these people, these ships then, were just the scum of the earth. I mean, all the good sailors had gone in the Navy. These were the leavings. The guys couldn't get in for moral turpitude. I mean, just terrible people. I've often thought about this. I don't want to make anybody feel bad. And I don't mean to make a joke of it, but I thought this once. Here I was at 15, hitchhiked all the way across the United States, didn't know enough to pour pee out of a boot. Got on a ship with the worst scum of the earth, got off that ship, got to another ship, went to another scum of the earth, and never was molested once. It makes you feel unattractive. Right. But on this first ship, these guys were tough guys, and I mean, I was very innocent then. I remember the first day I was on that ship, and I lay in my bunk afraid, and they start talking. They'd apparently been in port for about 3 or 4 days, and they'd done some terrible sexual things in San Francisco. I couldn't believe my ears. I said, "You realize, of course, they've all got black hair. These are the Catholics I've heard about." I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people, if you can imagine such a rotten thing as that. And eventually I found a role on that ship. I became the ship fool, you know. "Hey, kid, go down the engine room. Tell me we need a left-handed wrench. Kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease." And what they'd do every afternoon after their watch, they'd take a whiskey out of their sea bags. They weren't supposed to have it, but they all did. They'd drink whiskey and laugh and talk dirty. And one day a guy just turned to me and said, "Hey, you, Junior, how about you?" And he shoved the bottle in my face. "You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And I was dumb and I was stupid and I was young and I was afraid, but I drew the line there. Because I've been trained in the Lutheran Church, you don't drink that stuff, you don't go around people that do. And I promised my mother and my grandmother, and I promised on a Bible, I would never drink that stuff, right? And I was just going to tell them this. I was just getting ready to tell them, "How dare you stick that in my face, you big Catholic or whatever you are. Don't you ever do it. I'm a Lutheran." And I was just about to tell him that, and he said, "Well, how about it, kid? You think you're man enough?" And I heard a voice say, "God damn right." I've always been a little weak under pressure, too. So I had my first drink of whiskey out of the first whiskey bottle I was ever close to. And I threw it up, and they laughed. I felt terrible. And all the way across the rest of the trip, I'd sneak in that sea bag at least once a day and take a drink of whiskey to hold it down. And I'd throw it up, and I'd wipe it up. I just hated it, but I wanted so much for those guys to think I was a man, to accept me. And we were just coming into Pearl Harbor finally. They're still digging up ships off the bottom. And I'd done taking a drink of that crap. It was the day before my 16th birthday. I finally held a drink down. It was just terrible. I said, "Oh, God, how do I do it?" And all of a sudden, something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. About a known as sea shanty out of Summit. And I discovered that that's why people drink alcohol. I never put any great import into it. I've always admired the people in AA who have great insights that I never seem to have had. A few years ago, I heard a guy say, "When I held that first drink down, it was though I'd gone into a new garden of experience full of flowers and fruits to be savored for many years, until I left that garden to come to this wonderful program of recovery." Geez, I never did that. All I knew is if you drink and if you can breathe and you don't throw up, it makes you feel a lot better. That's what I learned. I learned how to smoke on that ship. Nobody in my family smoked. They all smoked, so I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. And one day I smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day, every day for the next 40-some years, until I realized it was making me bald. I learned to curse. I learned to lust effectively. I learned a lot of things on that ship. I got another ship, and I didn't become a terrible alcoholic, but the day after my first drink, I got drunk in Pearl Honolulu for the first time. So they bought me some beer, a whole bunch of beer. I got drunk. And I thought it was wonderful. I got sick, I threw up, and there's just something else I added along the way. Drink if you can, and smoke, and have fun, and talk dirty, and whatever you can do to be a real man. And when I was 17, finally, I went to the Navy and served the rest of the war in the Navy. At the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital up in Northern California, and they passed around a bunch of tests. I must have been good on tests, so I did very well, and they gave me an honorary high school diploma from the Armed Forces Institute. I went back to Wisconsin after the war and went to college after the war, the first class of veterans, 1946. Very few people in this room are old enough to remember that, but that was a remarkable time. It was the only time in American history where millions of people all got out of the service at once, and they all had the GI Bill. And so if they didn't have anything else to do, they'd go to school for a while, make a little dough. And really funny, you'd sit in freshman English class, they just jammed, and there'd be some old grizzled ex-sergeant sitting there next to some little honey just out of Plum Run High School or something. "Were you in the war?" "Yeah. Do you put out?" That was a very rude thing to say, but a lot of them did. They tell me. And I got married in college. I met this girl. I'd won some trophies for the university. I had some prestige. And I was kind of a big man on campus. And I met this girl who was just a freshman. And she had coal black hair and flashing black eyes. I'd never seen anything so exotic as that. And she won my heart. And she dropped the big bomb. She says, "I'm a Catholic." And I struggled in the net like a big old porpoise. But she had me, and we got married, and my grandmother went into depression for 2 years. Just, Jesus help him, Jesus help him. And I went out in the world. I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer. Wrote about big mooses like this here. And my favorite job I ever had. I liked it very much. The only problem was my wife began manifesting the terrible tendencies of Catholics and Catholic women that they never tell Protestant boys, but you find out it's too late. Catholic women, good Catholic women, have a tendency to bear young at a remarkable rate. Just boom. And I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just boom. I remember saying to her once, "Charlotte Kent, we use birth control." She said, "No." But I'll tell you something else, too. You're too young to know this, but I wouldn't have known what to have done if she'd have said yes. Because it's hard to realize in this modern era, but in those days, nobody ever talked about such things. I mean, I was in college and out of college and working in the world, and I don't suppose, maybe I'd heard the word condom once. Maybe in a Navy training film, where they showed this terrible woman, sinful woman, and told you if you're with her to wear a condom. And she made me so hot I didn't pay any attention. So I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. Because in those days, what you'd see, the bad guys would come around and say things like, "I got a rubber." And even they would be ashamed to go in and buy it. They'd have to hire somebody totally depraved. And even they would be ashamed. They'd go and say, "Hey, give me some cigarettes and some rubbers." And it's really all different now. At least in the drugstore by my house, these kids come in and say, "Hey, give me a package of condoms
and some cigarettes."
Yeah. Anyway, I try to get better jobs with this, all these kids. I got into advertising and public relations and worked around the country. I had ups and downs. I was always kind of flamboyant because I was flamboyant when I drank because I was so repressed when I was sober and I'd get in trouble sometimes. And I got sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. A lot of you little snots weren't even born, were you? We love you. I was not a bunch of old, burned-out fools in their late 30s and 40s with some of them with gray hair, and they sat around and said, "Poor old boobs, you know. And I don't know what they said. If you're new, you may think you hear this. I thought I heard it. You know, some old goof gets up there and says, "I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. One day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug. And I did. And I have just never been so damn happy." So I didn't go to AA very long because they were a little too simplistic for me. Well, then I got in a jam in the next city I was working in. I went to AA again. I went to AA off and on for years. Every time the heat was on, I went to AA. And not only was it good in those days to ease off your bosses. Nobody knew much about AA except it was a miracle organization. You could tell your boss, "I'm going to that AA thing, and I think it can help." Well, at least he gave you a couple of weeks to make your move. And you could come home and say things like, "Well, Charlotte, I know I've been kind of acting badly, but I've gone back to AA, and I think it'll work this time." She, "Oh, good, good, this is good. What do they want you to do?" "Well, they told me they want me to taper off." And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since they invented Aladdin, there's never been a moment's rest for any slipper anywhere. No, they didn't. They should have stopped you. We have to do the program. You, we have flops on. But I went to psychiatrists, I went to doctors, and did a lot of things just to get my emotions. And it all kind of went to hell in Texas in a matter of 2 weeks. I'd been holding my own. I thought I had a big job and making a lot of money. And I got fired off my job. I went out a little drunk for 3 or 4 days. I came home, and my wife had taken the children and left. She'd been setting this up. Apparently, they told her the company that they were going to fire me. They repossessed my car, and I stood with my clothes. And that's all I had. I couldn't believe this was really happening. And I knew I had to get out of Texas, because they put me back in that state hospital if I didn't. So I got out. I got a drive-away car. You know, they hire you to drive a car. I got a car to drive to Los Angeles, and I got as far as Phoenix. And lost the car, drunk, and got my teeth kicked out, and hustled some old lady in the AA club there for bus fare to get to Los Angeles, and wound up standing in front of a Skid Row mission, and my life was over. And I had done everything and been everywhere, and it was all over, and there was no answer. And I used to think, God, I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish I'd go to that AA and, you know, turn your life over to God and write all these things and whine and bitch. And I can't do that. But I knew there was something terribly wrong inside of me, and it wasn't drinking alcohol. Drinking alcohol stopped it for a while. And I knew I had to get off that street corner, and somebody told me there was an AA club at the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax for where the hell that was, and I found where that was. Guy said, Wilshire doesn't come down this far. You have to go up this hill to Hill Street and then cut over to Wilshire and go west. And it was raining to get off the street. And I counted later, 72 long blocks. That's a long way to walk when you're sick and your mouth is bleeding and you're desperate and it's raining. And a woman in New York asked me one time, how could you possibly walk that far when you were so desperate? Of course, the answer is simple. That's the only time you can. You could do it no other time. When you're desperate enough, you'll do whatever you have to do. And I got to that club, and apparently I'd been in there a few nights before drunk and denounced them. And they weren't glad to see me, and I wasn't glad to see them. And I hung around the club, and that night they had a meeting. I ate about 4 pounds of cake. That's what I could eat with my bleeding gums. And they had a meeting on gratitude, and I almost puked it up again. And afterwards, it was raining still. And, you know, when I went to AA, I used to give people $5 or $10 once in a while. I'd go, here, kid, good luck to you. And I thought it was about time for me to make a withdrawal. So I went up to after everybody went home, to the manager of the club. I said, I'm a newcomer. I'm looking for sobriety, but I have no place to stay, and it's raining. Is there any help I could get anywhere? They'd like to hear that. And the guy said, yeah, you're in luck, kid. On the parking lot, a guy named Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc there last summer. It's in the tall grass. You can sleep with that as dry as toast. You want me to sleep in an abandoned car? He says, yeah, that's a good deal, huh? Yes, it was. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And I slept in that abandoned car that night, cold and hungry. Got up the next morning, came in the club, and it was Sunday. They were having a spiritual meeting. I had about 4 pounds of cake, and they talked about Jesus or somebody who was after me. And hung around that club that afternoon, and that night there was another meeting, ate some more cake, and just lurked and sick and desperate, kept raining. And I slept in that abandoned car again that night. And this went on for days. I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe I'm dead. Maybe my grandmother was right. This is what happens when you marry a Catholic. Just an eternity of being cold, hungry, sick, and having people tell you about AA. Yes. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be, had no intention to be sober. I've often thought, what was the difference? What made the difference? Of all the times I wanted to stay sober, I couldn't, and the one time I didn't even want to, I did. They say there are no authorities in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is not true. Do you know who authorities are? Authorities are speakers they bring in from far away to speak at conventions. We have an authority from Las Vegas. We have an authority from Pittsburgh. We have an authority from North Carolina. We have an authority from California. I'll tell you, now I want to be humble about this and be modest. But I am something of an authority in Toronto. I go there every January. They have a day with Clancy I, if you can imagine what a thrill that must be. Well, that should tell you all you need to know. Well, I'm up in Toronto in January. The good speakers are down speaking in Florida and Texas and Louisiana. But I get down there in the summer. You have a guy who talks in the morning, a local guy talks, and I give a talk on something like the history of A or the traditions or the concepts or something. Then in the afternoon, they have a question and answer meeting. And they ask the authority questions, and he answers. And I really like that part because I've discovered I have a native talent to take a question and weave a veritable tapestry of BS while I think of the answer. Perhaps we could look at that from a different angle. Sometimes tears of self-admiration just fill my eyes. A few years ago, a woman got up in the back like this. She says, "Clancy, I have a question." "Yes." She says, "If you don't mind, I wouldn't like one of your long answers." Somebody ought to slap that bitch. But I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. She says, "Every year you come up here and tell us again and again, all the years you slipped and how sad your life was, how tragic. Now you've been sober forever and everything just working out and everything is wonderful. What made the difference? We all know about your slipping, you're getting better. What made the difference? Could you just tell me in a sentence or two?" I wanted to go back and snatch your ball. But what I did was say, "Ma'am, I couldn't possibly do that in a sentence. There's so many psychological, physical reasons that to go into. Perhaps someday we could sit down over a cup of coffee and we could talk about it. I couldn't do it in a sentence or two." She threw off my rhythm is what she did. That night I was having dinner before the meeting. I was having a shower before dinner, and the answer came. The answer I could have given her. And I probably wouldn't have because I didn't like the answer. It was a touch of nothing little answer. I like answers with a lot of body, with a little panache, with a little vivacity. We have a lot of new people all in this section here. I hope they'd go home tonight saying things like, "Did you hear what Clancy said? Wet birds don't fly at night." "Did you hear what Clancy said? Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon." Now these answers, they mean nothing, but they give the newcomer hope. The answer I thought of in that shower was such a tedious little two-bit answer. You know what the answer was? "This is the first time that I ever hurt so bad and sunk so low as to take some of these stupid A actions that were way beneath my intelligence and my integrity." That isn't much of an answer, is it? But I'm not talking about big things like steps and inventories. I'm talking about little things. Like, for example, styrofoam cups hadn't been invented yet. So every meeting drank out of porcelain cups. At the end of every meeting, somebody had to wash them. And the old timers got sick of washing them, so they tried to find some new goof to wash them. Might point to me and say, you boy, without the teeth, you want to wash dishes tonight?" If I had any strength or integrity left, I'd have said, "No, I don't want to wash dishes tonight or tomorrow night or any other night. Why don't you lick them off with that big ugly tongue of yours?" You know? But I had to stay out of the rain, so I found myself saying, Somebody else said, "Can you stay after the meeting tomorrow night and help mop?" "Can you come early tomorrow night and set up the chairs?" Just terrible. I got to be kind of a fixture around the club. I was living in a parking lot, so I was close by at all times. And guys would occasionally buy me a sandwich. And there was Joe Quinn, the guy who owned the car I lived in, about once in a while come by and throw me an apple and say, "Someday you can eat this, kid. You son of a bitch." But somehow I stayed sober. I mean, I got to, you know, if nothing else, I guess old timers were taking their newcomers and saying, "If you don't stop now, you might turn out like him." Oh. But the thing about, Tom mentioned it today, in many groups where there are pockets of enthusiasm, there's a certain, it just, they never stop, they never let up. I was over maybe 2 or 3 weeks and living in that car, and I had some sandwiches now, and I'm still living in the same. A guy gave me a green corduroy jacket that I wore night and day. I still have it. I put it on my birthday. I can't hardly get into it, but I still love it. But they, when you stay sober 2 or 3 weeks, pretty soon they start saying, got a sponsor? Time to get a sponsor. Everybody needs a sponsor. And I'd had a number of sponsors over the year. I had sponsors. I selected sponsors well. When I had a lot of kids, I selected a baby doctor to be my sponsor. I selected the editor of the El Paso Times to be my sponsor when I worked at the El Paso Times. I tried to sponsor people with, have sponsors with dual abilities to help me. And I'm going to tell you this, new people, they're going to ask you to get a sponsor. And I'm going to tell you this, I hate to tell you this, but they're all going to seem very nice at first. Oh, welcome. You're the most important person in the room. First of all, get that out of your mind. I'm the most important person. You run a close second. Because if I ain't here, I don't care who is here. But they'll all be very nice. But sooner or later, they will always begin to stick their nose in your business. Sooner or later. And I've tried to avoid that if I could. And I used to see this guy come in down to the club. He was a movie actor. And he named Bob Bailey. And he was just a character actor. He wasn't a big star, but he always played roles. We played loving roles or give people money or loving brother-in-law or something. I thought, that'll be my new sponsor. I'll work on that. I'll play this guy like a zipper. I'll get some money, I'll get some front teeth, I'll get some clothes. I've been sober a little while, I'll go back and look good in New York anyway. I'll get a job in an advertising agency, and I'll work hard, and I'll save my money. And I'll come back here someday, maybe in a couple of years, and I may buy this club, and I'll burn this goddamn thing down. And I hope they're all in it. You know, I really, a lot of people didn't have this feeling, but a few years ago I saw this movie, Carrie, where this girl burns down the high school with all... And I said, yeah, that's what I meant, you know. I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? I gave my best newcomer look. He said, yeah, but I want you to do what I tell you, kid. Oh, sure, Bob. I want sobriety on an all-time basis. So he became my sponsor. And I've said this 1,000 times, I guess. In looking back, that guy should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played in the movies, because they were totally foreign to his basic nature. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Just, I got feeling like Quasimodo. Look, Bob, I'm ringing the bell. Look. Hey. And I've looked back many times and wondered, why would I take that crap from that guy? Because at that stage of my life, and for several years before that, I was in a mode where I don't take crap from anybody. I have quit jobs that guys would give their lives to have, and I quit them because they gave me too much crap. Big dough sometimes. If you want that, when he said, give me that much crap, get another writer as good as I am if you can find one, Jack, because I'm gone. And I know how many nights in bars people might forward say, you talk a lot. You don't seem like you're very much. You don't think so, son of a bitch? Why don't you try me? And I got knocked on my can a lot. But everybody knew I was tough. Stay with that guy. He's crazy. He's tough. Now, after I was sober a while, I thought, why did I have to be so tough all the time, or appear to be so tough and so defiant? And it took me a while to understand that. I had to listen to some other guys talk about their experiences before I could put it together in mine. You know why? Because all my life, I secretly knew I was a weakling, and I hate it. I despise being a weakling. I despise a white worm's crawling inside me. And no one's ever going to find out I'm a weakling, no matter what I have to do. I'll fight. I'll quit. You defy me, and I'll do whatever to hell with you, Beth. And so it's an odd thing, because when you come to A with that attitude, you can't take an advice, because that would make people think you're weak. I can't. I'm not going to do that crap. Why? Because it makes me look like I'm a weak, and when people know I'm weak. So really, that defiance has killed a lot of people. And the irony is, if you could ever surmount that somehow, or feel bad enough to surmount that, and eventually do little things that enable you to stay here, you know that one of the great ironies of life is that it enables you to gradually become strong like you've been pretending to be all along. And then, when you're strong, you can now afford to be weak. But you can't afford to be weak when you're weak. It's a funny little phenomenon. But why would I take that crap from that guy? He gave me some crap. He didn't always give me crap. He tried to be nice to me, but I was a nasty guy. I've thought about that many times. I sponsored a lot of people over the years. And they sent slippers to me, a lot of slippers to me. But I've thought many times, what would I do if Clancy Imeslin circa 1958 came into my office and started giving me that smart mouth and explaining why he was so smart and without teeth and mouth bleeding and dirty clothes. And I wonder what I'd do for a guy like that. I don't know what I could do. I'm afraid I'd get angry and say, get out of here. Tell you're ready to do something about it. You know, leave me alone. It's just, I don't know how in the world you survive when you're like that. But I think the reason I took that crap was this. Because he'd take me once in a while to meetings with him, and I'd hear him talk around the club and this and that. And a couple times I heard him mention emotions that I thought I was the only one I had, knew that I had. And he had them. And he talked about other emotions and feelings and situations. And I thought, my God, how does he know that? He must have them too. And he must have had them anyway. And I began to develop a great... I'll tell you what it's like. Like standing on a cliff somewhere and surrounded by fog and rain, and all of a sudden, there's no way out, and all of a sudden here comes a rope through the fog and falls at your feet. And eventually another rope comes, and eventually another rope comes, and one day there's a little walkway, and one day there's a little road, and one day there's an 8-lane superhighway. But it all gets back to that rope that came across the first. And that's what I was talking about this morning. Identification. Beginning to feel there is someone who knows how I feel. If only partially, they know how I feel. And when I thought this guy knew how I feel, I respected him or something. Because I began trying to win his friendship. I want him to like me. And I did things that I wouldn't have ordinarily done. I wouldn't have done it for my father. I wouldn't have done it for Jesus. I did him for this guy because I wanted him to like me. And that's one of the great things, to have a sponsor who's a good AA and then do what he says. You don't have to do it because you think you want to be a good AA. You want to do it because you want him to like you, I guess, whatever the reason is. But you can take the actions. And little by little, I stayed sober. And over a period of time, I'd say, Bob, I'm hungry and I'm living in an abandoned car. I can eat once in a while, people buy me meals, but God, that's no way. I'm living like an animal. What should I do? He said, get a job. I said, get a job, for Christ's sake. Look how terrible I look. He said, get a terrible job. And I did that. I followed that right to the boot. And little by little, I did things. Over a period of time, he had me take a little action and get chopped. I'd get fired off him. I'd almost cry because my mouth would get me in trouble. But little by little, I stayed sober. Probably one of the great turning spots in my life. Came out 6 months sober, and he'd been after me to write an inventory, and I told him I'd take my inventory to the psychiatrist. I don't need to take it with an out-of-work actor. And one day I lost my job as a dishwasher, and I got fired as a dishwasher. And I thought, 6 months sober, I'm not even an alcoholic, and I can't hold a job as a dishwasher. I might as well die. And I decided to kill myself and go to walk in the ocean, and I couldn't find the ocean that day. But I called him up, and I'd been out of that abandoned car 3 or 4 times, but when I lost jobs, I'd be back in them again. It was just hideous. I called him, I said, Bob, this is Clancy. I want you to, I know you've tried to help me, but I can't go on anymore. I just can't go on anymore. Said, why don't you write your damn inventory the way I told you? I said, Bob, I've been around AA a long time. I know about the inventory. In my judgment, that's the last thing in the world. And I'm so full of remorse and regret, I can barely stand it to dig up all that more stuff. In my judgment, that'll kill me, Bob. And he explained that to me. He said, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. He said, you're a loser. You're a loser. And I came out of that phone booth and I went back to that club and I got some paper for the guy. I said, I'm going to write my inventory. And I was so upset, I put down things I would never tell a soul, not anybody. Not big things, dirty, little, rotten, snappy. God, it's just, I was so upset, I was telling the truth just constantly. And I got all done with it, I had pages of it. And And I felt better because I'd proved that didn't work. So I felt better about that. And I went on about my business for a couple more days. He came by one day in his car and said, "Okay, get your inventory. We're going to take your fifth step." I don't think I'm ready for that, Bob. I want to get in touch with my emotions first and see how I can deal with it. Shut up and get in the car. So I reached for, had my inventory hidden under my seat of my abandoned car. We took from Santa Monica to Oxnard and gave me a flashlight. And I read this hideous thing. And it read twice as bad as I remembered it. Just dirty. Just the person you want to just, oh, get it. That's all, Bob. Said, "You finished?" I said, "Yeah." He leaned over and said, "That's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid." And I said, "Thought it was." I've taken that same trip over 200 times since then. Some with people in this room. And they've got a flashlight and I'm driving. And you know, let me explain this part before I read it. It's an amazing thing. I'll tell you something, if you're kind of new, if you're thinking about your inventory, all good inventories are the same, as far as I know. They contain the same elements. They vary all over the place, but they contain the same elements. Every good inventory seems to contain lack of self-worth, sometimes self-hatred, a great deal of guilt, much, much resentment, terrible fear, and occasional lashing out at the world to punish them for how they've hurt me. And in one week a few years ago, I heard a daughter of one of the most famous men in the 20th century, and a few days later, a guy who blamed her rich father for her problems, a guy just out of the Washington State Penitentiary who blamed his father because he'd never known him. It's always something. But those things are still there. And it's all over the world. That's what makes AA such a remarkable place. Because it works at a level you don't even know yet. That's why you can't trust your judgment as to whether or not you should do these things. But my sponsor took that stuff and he made me make an amends to people. Amends to people that I wouldn't have done that for $1,000. Make an amends to my father who I hadn't talked to in 10 years because he had screwed up my mother and my life. And all sorts of things. And little by little, I stayed sober. And I was 2 years sober, finding out a job I held as a little writer in a medical corporation. And I still didn't have any front teeth, but I had learned to carry my lip like this. A lot of people didn't know I didn't have front teeth. I went to work every day, and my sponsor made me go to work. There was no excuse not to go to work as long as I was alive. And I'd go to work. And on that job, I learned some of the great spiritual lessons of AA. Now, if you're kind of new, I want you to listen to these. You won't read them in the book, but I'll tell you, they are the great spiritual lessons, some of the great spiritual lessons of AA. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Children, waiters and waitresses, employees. On days you know you're having a bad day, watch that damn mouth, because you could accidentally cut people to ribbons and never know what happened in your relationship with it. And on and on. And I didn't learn them well, but I learned them well enough to hold that job. And eventually, 5 years sober, I was the director of advertising for that big medical corporation. And I had front teeth now. And I used them. And if you're new and have lost teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually perfect, they grow back. What do they know? They don't know shit. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio. We became the number one hard rock station in the world. And we all wore shiny suits and said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" But you get sick of pimping to teenagers. When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations with oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkly green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, Texas, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Finally, somebody told me what to do about that. They got me a metronome, and you use that for the rhythm system. And that beats the hell out of what they call coitus interruptus. That makes you nervous a lot. And all my kids are growing up now. I have 3 daughters who are turning 12 this year at AA, all doing well in their AA sobriety. The rest of my kids aren't alcoholics, so they're not in AA. My youngest
child, his son, he's 36 now. He creates some arcade games. He's a big engineer. Tries to explain to me, and I tell him to shut up. Only one of my children has turned out bad. And I guess you have to accept that with the good. My oldest daughter has turned out to be a district attorney. We had so hoped for a public defender, but no. A few years ago, she was home at Christmas. She said, "Dad, remember when we were little girls, you used to send us to our room?" I said, "Sure, honey." She said, "When you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to your room." I didn't have no reason to go to Albuquerque. But, so I live in a house out by the ocean down. Everything is fine. Isn't that wonderful? I just want to take about 5 minutes now. I'll ask the introduction of a five-minute talk I want to give to you new people. And then I'll be out of here. Because I'm sick of finishing my talk while they're dancing by the podium. Yeah. I suppose the great turning spot in my life came. And such a simple, small thing was the one thing that I could not accept. I could never concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, and that is apparently a necessity. Even when I was new in my early months, as you might imagine, I'd go to discussion meetings and I'd talk at length, advise old timers what they're doing wrong and what they could do better. And one meeting, they're having a meeting on the steps or the first step, I don't know, something, but I was explaining to the people, well, I couldn't take the first step. I can't take the first step, really. Because I'm not really an alcoholic. My problems really come from a deeper, more psychological reason. I drink, but the drinking gets me in trouble, but it isn't the drinking is the problem. And I said, that's why many of these steps do not apply to people like me. Some of them will work for me, but I really, it's a very difficult situation to be in. And of course, my sponsor had snitches in every meeting in the world. And I was ratted out about 5 seconds after the meeting was over. And in about 2 or 3 minutes, I'm going to tell you what he told me in 2 or 3 weeks. It got down to this. He said, in effect, "So you're not an alcoholic, really, as you say." "That's right. I wish I were, Bob, but I'm not." He says, "You don't believe you can take the first step?" I said, "No, not really." He said, "The first step asked you to admit you're an alcoholic? I'm not an alcoholic." He said, "Why don't you read it and see what it says?" I've heard a thousand of them. "Read it. Where does it say admits you're an alcoholic?" It says, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol." "Are you powerless over alcohol?" "No, not really." "Sometimes I handle it, sometimes I don't, but I'm not one of these guys who take 3 drinks and go rape nuns and hold up banks and go to prison. I'm not like that. I'm a guy that just, I've got some emotions and I get drink a little too much over, that's all. Many times I've been thoughtlessly overserved." He says, "It doesn't mean, you hear all these stories in meetings where you think the alcoholic's the guy goes to prison and nut house and jails. It doesn't mean that. A lot of people do, but that's what it means. What seems to make an alcoholic is this, that after 2 or 3 drinks, alcohol has a tendency to alter your perception of reality. Doesn't mean you're going to go crazy. You may go home. You may go to Mexico. You may fall in love with an 89-year-old lady on a walker. You know, who knows? But what it means is you cannot, when you start drinking, you can't really control where it's going to end up." That's true, but you know. He said, "But that's all it means. It doesn't mean that you have to drink gallons of booze every day. It means that alcohol does something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. It alters your perception of reality after 2 or 3 drinks. I guess that's not my fault, but that's all you have to admit. Not that you, anything else. Can you admit that?" "Yeah." I said, "But that isn't the reason my life is screwed up. You don't understand that. My life is screwed up before I ever drank, it seems to me." He says, "It doesn't say that. Why don't you read it? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. In the English language, Spud, dash means end of thought, beginning of new thought. You've now admitted your powers over alcohol, and now you also have to admit your life is screwed up. Is that right?" "Not my fault." You don't have to admit it's your fault. You have to admit that it's there. If you're having trouble drinking, you're having trouble not drinking. Is that right? He says, now look, if either one of these characteristics were here, nobody would be in AA. If you could drink, you'd be out drinking. If you could stop drinking and be comfortable, you'd stop drinking and be comfortable. But we are people who apparently have found that our lives is very painful and that drinking makes it all right. And now drinking has become a problem and we're caught in a terrible vice. You can't stay sober and you can't drink. So you stay sober till you have to drink, till you drink till you have to stay sober. And that's all they have to admit. That's why people come to AA. Yeah, I understand that. I can do that. He said, good. Because that's what an alcoholic is. You have just said you're an alcoholic. That's all an alcoholic is. No mysterious things, no mystique, no nothing. People want to read pages of documents into it. It boils down to this, that you and I, or people like me, have difficulty in life, and that drinking makes it better. As a result of drinking, my sobriety gets worse when I get sober. But eventually the drinking gets bad too, and now I'm caught. And that dreadful paradox, I can't drink and I can't stay sober, and nobody understands that my problem really isn't alcohol, it's all these things you don't understand. And everybody in this room, I'm sure, has come into AA at one time or another and said, thought to myself, but my case is different. They don't understand. Now, what would be such a big thing about admitting the first step? I'll tell you why. Because at that time, I was smart enough to know if I were an alcoholic, I would have to do those other 11 steps. Because this is the only thing that has ever worked for alcoholics on a continuing basis in the 7,000 written years of alcohol usage. Nothing else. There's all sorts of claims and recovery movements and all sorts, but they don't have any rooms full of people. This is the only thing that ever worked. And so I did these steps. I didn't do them willingly. I didn't do them with zeal. I put off that inventory as long as I could. I knew I had to do it eventually. It's like going to the hospital, doctor with ulcerated tooth. I'll do it when it gets bad enough. I made amends, I've tried to help people, I've done things. A lot of times in my life I've just done things in AA because I know that's what you're supposed to do. I didn't have any zeal for it at all. But it gradually changed my perception of life. Because if you're new, I want to tell you the purpose of AA. Now you look at old Tom there, 44 years of sobriety, and me 42 years. You think you've been dry that long, there'd be a spontaneous combustion. You just... But... It isn't. That is, you don't stay to get more and more sober. You'll be as sober at 30 days as you'll ever be. The purpose of AA and its steps and its people, as far as I believe, and I believe this with all my soul, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to change my perception of reality, to make the same facts look different, to change my relationship to the world around me, to enable me to live in the world. For example, the best doctor I ever knew in the Texas State Mental Hospital I was committed to as a suicide told me I would have to take medications for the rest of my natural life, strong ones, because my emotions were so intense. And when I got sober this time, I couldn't find any of them. I couldn't find any. Remember, you put me on a charge account to get them. So I had to live without them, and I had to do the steps instead. And it turned out to be that's what worked. There are people who will tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous were good for your drinking, but for your emotions, you need something more. You may need special help. You may be tri or quadruple polar, for all we know. Strange things are happening. And I would say this, that maybe, I'm not saying it's not true, but I've been in jail 32 times, which isn't a world's record. It's good for an advertising executive. I've been in two veterans hospitals, chained down. I've been in the Beloit, Wisconsin hospital, chained in a bed, while my wife came in, who was a nurse there, went upstairs, had a baby, came down, said goodbye, and went home again. And I was still there. bitch, help. I was a successful suicide brought back to life. I was committed for an indefinite to life to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Victory, Texas. I think I can speak on behalf of those who are emotionally challenged. Speaking on behalf of those who are emotionally challenged, I'll tell you, AA, if you do it, does what it's supposed to do to change your life. I live at peace more than I ever thought. The last thing I want to say is this. When I was 15 years sober in some hideous fit of misperception, I left a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 27 years I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you give up your good career to run this damn mission on Skid Row where people are dying? And I I've never been able to think of a good answer of that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it was spiritual. But Monday morning, I'll go to work. My car still wants to get off the freeway at Beverly Hills and go to offices where pretty girls in tight sweaters would say, "Here's your coffee, Mr. Immelslin. Anything else?" I go downtown, go to Skid Row, step over the bodies of dying men, women, get my office, look at my office in the morning. We go over the people who died over the weekend, or been stabbed, or smashed their head on the sidewalk in a convulsion. And we're not a treatment center. We're way below. We're trying to keep people alive. Some of our people somehow make it and get an A eventually. But when I go home at night, I feel more like a man inside of me than I ever did going down all those elevators, popping my fingers in my shiny suit and being slick. And it really has paid off for me a great deal. If you're new, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. Even if you get a sponsor and go to meetings and take the actions and listen to your people ahead of you, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you can have your own mission. There's only so many to go around. I've got mine, and that's for you. But I can guarantee you that you will find yourself walking in the world with a degree of dignity that you never would have thought. You may even do what I do, come to finally believe God didn't hate me, and then eventually come to believe he loved me. No more than you, no less than you. And I didn't, that's some breakthrough of mine, but that's where people ahead of me who showed me. And I believe that God loves me. I believe God loves the people I'm stepping over dying on the streets. And the puzzle is just, why are they dying if God loves them too? Because they will not surrender and take actions they do not approve of. It's that simple. It sounds like it isn't, but it really is. So I'll tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous works. It works for people like you, and it works like for people like me. You've had a great selection of speakers this weekend who tell you various facets of it. You'll hear some more tomorrow morning. But it all gets down to this. You got to do what it says. You don't have to like it. Don't have to really be polished at it. But you must surrender to the fact that you can't stay sober and you can no longer drink. And there's only one answer for you, and it is called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.